Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I have a returning guest. I have the lovely Grant Nicholas of Feeder, and I got to chat to Grant at the beginning of the lockdown to talk records. And he's back on, and this time we're going to talk gigs. So you've probably heard whenever guests come back on, we generally like to talk a kind of a reworking of the song choice questions, and we base it all around gigs, you know, first gigs, first festivals, dream lineups and stuff like that. So and it's a wonderful chat, this one with Grant. He's such a nice guy. And yeah, we talk obviously about the new Feeder record that's coming soon, the new Feeder tour. And we get to talk to Grant about what it's like being on tour with the Rolling Stones and U2, and there's some crazy little stories that are just, yeah, remarkable. And I don't think many people get to kind of have their moments in their lives to be in rooms with such, you know, legends of the music industry. And so yeah, we touch on that and so much other stuff. It's a lovely natter, and it's coming your way in just a sec. Not before I've said a big thank you to Scroobius Pip, everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Jay for putting this together. Thanks to 76 for producing this podcast, and biggest thanks obviously go to you lot for always supporting this podcast. Always giving it a little like or a share, you know, dropping me little messages on the socials. It really makes this sort of thing worth doing. If it's your first time listening, then go check out, once you finish listening to this, go check out Grant's first episode on the podcast. And yeah, go get stuck into the back catalogue, whether you want to hear me talking to the Foo Fighters, Tommy Lee of Motley Crue, Idols, Sleaford Mods, Suede, oh gosh, James Acaster, Ed Gamble, Maxine Peake, Amanda Abington, Joe Hartley, Thomas Turgoose, Butch Vig, yeah, the list is endless. So go and have a rummage. There's over 340 episodes for you to go and have a little look at and a listen to. So you can do that wherever you get your podcasts, or you can just go to your one-stop shop and find out about the Patreon. And that's all at offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. Let's get on with the episode. Please enjoy Off the Beat and Track Podcast live gig special with Grant Nicholas. Sorry, I've interrupted the podcast, but with good reason. Hotel Chocolat are our sponsors. You know that now because I tell you about it every episode. But they've been super kind now, and you may have heard me talking about the products from the Cacao Bar, and there's gins, cream liqueurs, all sorts of wonderful chocolatey goodies. And what they've done is they've set a page up on the website that you can go to, and all you've got to do is, just for you Off the Beaten Track listeners, go over there, answer a question, and you could win the full range delivered to your front door. I mean, that's kind of them. All you have to do is go to this place, hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. That's OTBT as in Off the Beaten Track podcast. hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. Go get your grubby little mitts on some deliciously chocolatey drinks, courtesy of our sponsors, Hotel Chocolat. I'll get back to the podcast. It's Off the Beat and Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network with me, Stu Whiffin. Okay, right, we are recording. Grant, how are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks.
Sorry, you're literally about to have a gob full of coffee then, weren't you?
cup of tea, yeah. Actually, I've had about three coffees this morning, so I thought if I have any more, I'd be talking about it so quickly.
Well, this is your second time on Off the Beaten Track. The first time was, I guess, not probably right at the height of the first lockdown, and we spoke about that. But I don't want to sort of dwell too much on the kind of lockdown. But I want to ask,
okay,
since everything has kind of reopened, let's not look too much into what's happening now. Let's try and stay positive. But if looking at when all the restrictions dropped, tell me what it was like for Feeder. What happened?
Well, I mean, it was great. I mean, obviously, we've had, you know, I mean, same as most bands, we've had tours cancelled, which we're really upset about. But we had obviously a whole bunch of festivals that we're like, are they going to be on? Are they going to be off? But we ended up doing about, I think, 7 festivals. So that was great just to be back on stage again. I mean, like the first one we did was called Bug Jam. And I have to admit, I was pretty nervous because, we haven't played, you know, for so long. But as soon as you walked down to the stage, it was fine. But it was just sort of like great to be back. It was almost like a little bit surreal, actually, being on stage again. And obviously, you know, doing like a festival is quite nerve-wracking at the best of times. Yeah. So, I mean, we could have maybe eased ourselves back in with a smaller gig first.
Sure.
But it was great to get back out there and just to be playing again, you know, and it's amazing how fast it comes back to you, you know?
Yeah. And it must be so, you know, whatever you're putting out there, the crowd must be giving it back just as much, because it's like they've been starved of it as much as you've been starved of performing. Do you know what I mean? It's just like just a perfect combination.
Yeah, definitely. I think people have really missed music. And I think even myself, you know, you realise, you know, during the lockdown thing, how important actually music is, just for your mental health and well-being. You know, it's a very powerful thing, music, and that, you know, the world's a different place, you know, when it's not happening. I think people maybe have appreciated, you know, what bands do a bit more, and just like the whole power of music, because it is a really good, I mean, I love music, and that's why I do, you know, that's why I want to be in a band, and, you know, to write music is something that I love doing, but it's such an important thing. And I think and I think sort of during the whole, you know, past 2 years, I think people have probably like rediscovered a lot of bands and stuff they haven't probably listened to for a while, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Well, let's go back, because I'm going to talk about live shows on this episode. So I want to ask you first, Grant, the first live show that you remember going to.
Well, apart from a sixth form band at school, they were called No Parking, I think. it's a great name. I always remember that name.
Great.
You know, actually, they were a big influence on me, because, you know, as soon as I saw that band, it was like, wow, this is what I want to do. But I suppose the first, like, proper band I saw was, I think it was Ozzy Osbourne. I think I said Black Sabbath once, but I'm pretty sure it was Ozzy Osbourne. And I think it was either on the Diary of a Madman tour or the Blizzard of Oz tour. It was. I can't remember where she was. And we had this maths teacher at school who was a really cool guy, and he used to organise taking. He looked like the least like rock guy you could ever imagine. You know, sort of super conservative, and just looked like a typical kind of maths teacher or whatever. And he at that era, not putting down maths teachers, and he was really into heavy rock. So he used to organise like taking, like, kids from the school to go and see bands play at the Colston Hall in Bristol.
So a school trip involved going to see Ozzy Osbourne.
It was a kind of so you could sort of pay money and go and see him. It was brilliant. I mean, you just go there, just be your head banging for the whole time, come out with a very sore neck, and, you know, come back home with our kind of often a bootleg T-shirt, because we were so excited, like, going into the venue, we didn't realise that the proper T-shirts were inside. So there was bootleggers everywhere in those days. So we buy some dodgy, you know, knockoff, you know, Black Sabbath T-shirt, you know, kind of whoever was playing. But yeah, it was definitely Ozzy Osbourne, and it was an absolutely blinding gig. I remember it really well. It had a massive impact on me, and I must have been about probably 11 or something.
Yeah,
maybe 11 or 12. And I remember, for those like guitar player guys out there who might be listening in, he had this guitarist called Randy Rhodes. He was a really amazing guitar player. He was like sort of destined to be, not like an Eddie Van Halen, but he was really respected in that world, you know, amazing guitar player. So I was very, very lucky to see him, because I think he died a few weeks later in a plane crash.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was the first big band I saw, and you know, pretty cool one, I think, to see, because I mean, Black Sabbath had been a massive influence on me as well. So,
and when you say like it, you know, it really impacted on you, like what it impacted, as in like, I want a bit of this.
Yeah, I mean, I decided like very sort of young that I really wanted to be in a band. I didn't really dream of being a singer. I wanted to play guitar and I wanted to write songs. And even from about the age of 10, I was sort of like dreaming about that. And then when I went to see like a proper concert, I just heard like the drums like through the PA and the power of it. It just absolutely blew me away. And in those days, there was no barriers. So you were right, you know, you were literally just sort of like chin on the stage. You know what I mean? You could put your drink on the floor. It was so... It was so much more relaxed. So you could really get up close now. And just to watch like Randy Rose and even Ozzy, I mean, he was just like such a great performer. You just couldn't take your eyes off him. He was just insane, you know, in a really good way. He had a fantastic band. It was just, it just had a massive impact on me. Just the power of it, just the excitement of it all. And it kind of stuck with me really. And I was completely hooked after that.
And Ozzy's voice is phenomenal, isn't it?
It is, because he's, you know, Ozzy, so and I'm unique. Like, you know, I hope you wouldn't mind me saying that. It's not about, and I think I mentioned this in an interview actually a couple of weeks ago, it's not about being the best singer in the world. It's about having like an identity and a style. And Ozzy's got a really, you just know his voice instantly. And he's quite an unusual singer. He's not a typical rock singer.
Yeah.
But as soon as you hear him, you know it's him, don't you?
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
He has that kind of harmonizer sound he uses on his voice, which has made it quite distinctive. But just the way he sings and the tone of his voice, you know, he may not be like technically the best singer out there, but he's got a real, you know, style. And I think to me that's more important.
Definitely. And I think I found out more about Sabbath through in the early 90s, like becoming obsessed with like Faith No More and thinking, people like, oh, if you like Patton's voice, you should check out Sabbath. Mm. And I was like, oh, really? And like, I can tell the kind of, there's very similar, like when Patton wails, you can see the sort of, hear the similarities between what he does and what Ozzy does. And I think, you know, that obviously is a huge influence on that band anyway.
I mean, Sabbath are a massive influence on me and, you know, big influence on Feeder, because obviously, you know, it's affected my writing. I mean, the first sort of guitar player that I was really, really kind of into, so it was Tony Iommi, you know, from Black Sabbath. He just had it, because he had a great style as well, you know, very much about riffs. He did do lead work as well, but I think he's more known for his riffs.
Yeah.
Great riffs as well. And that was a massive influence on me, like sort of learning to play guitar, like trying to work out like Paranoid and NIB and War Pigs. And, you know, you can still hear it now in Feeder songs. I mean, especially on our new album. I mean, I love that sound and just what they did. And they've been, you know, hands up, you know, they have been a big influence on us. And me particularly as a writer and a guitar player.
Wonderful. Well, let's talk about you as a writer, frontman, guitarist. Yeah. What was the first live show you performed at? And tell me you had a name up there with no parking.
Mate, it was all. Well, listen, I want to give you two quick ones because I don't want to bore everyone listening. But this was so early on. You could barely call it a band. I couldn't even play chords. I was literally, didn't know how to tune a guitar. I just used to sort of, you know, and it was like single strings. I actually remember the song in my head. I wrote, it was absolutely dreadful. But anyway, the band consisted of, it was almost a bit of a White Stripes vibe. So it's basically me on guitar. There was no singer in the band. And there was a drummer that had the smallest drum kit I've ever seen in my life. It was just a snare drum and this little tiny bass drum and a cymbal. You know, it was almost like toy. It was almost a toy kit. And then there was this guy, I think his name was Justin Meek or something, if I remember right. And he used to play like a couple of chords on the piano. It was absolutely dreadful. But the band was called The Flames. I still remember it, and I remember doing this sort of trying to draw a really cool logo. But that was, I mean, that was way before I started to really learn how to play guitar like properly, and, you know, and learn how to tune a guitar. But my first, I suppose, semi-decent band, I must have been maybe 11, 12, maybe a bit older actually, and it was called Sweet Leaf after Black Sabbath song,
right?
So that's how much like that sounds, you know, you must have been an influence on me back then. And it was actually we weren't too bad. We used to play Paranoid, we used to play we used to play songs by Police, do a Space Oddity, you know, a David Bowie. We still Hotel California. I mean, that really badly. But that was, I mean,
were you singing then, Grant?
Really
I mean, you were singing.
I sung a little, not really. There was a singer. Well, we had a couple of different. There was a few different school bands, but. But yeah, no. I used to be. I was a little bit too shy. I think I sung one song that I'd written and was absolutely dreadful. I even remember what it was called.
Go on.
Check this out for a title. I think it was called Spotlight.
By Flames.
I mean, I was young. I was very young. No, Spotlight by Sweet Leaf. That was.
All right, Sweet Leaf, of course. Yeah.
Sorry, my cat thing's going off in the background. You can hear. It's like a cat time of thing. So you can hear my wife's voice on here in a minute. There you go. It's not me doing mad voices. And then I think my later band after that was called Albatross, after the Fleetwood Mac song.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, Sweet Leaf was the first kind of semi-decent band, but my very first encounter being kind of on stage, I suppose, you know, doing sort of music in some capacity, was with the Flames.
Yeah. Okay, well,
it's not that bad a name. You think about it, it sounds quite like almost like a 1950s kind of band name, doesn't it? It sounds almost like a rockabilly band or some rock and roll band.
It's a vast improvement on No Parking.
No Parking. Anyway.
There's right. Nothing better than just having a little look about on the posters outside working men's clubs at the names of bands. There's some absolute gems there. My favourite of all time, Loose Change. Like that takes some beating.
That's absolutely brilliant. It just made you laugh, didn't it?
Grant, tell me about the first festival you remember going to.
Do you know, I think the first, I probably went to a few local ones, like growing up in Wales, but they were more like, I remember there was one called Mayday Spectacular. It was just like local bands and stuff. I probably played a few of those, but the first kind of proper festival I remember going to was actually Reading Festival. I mean, I'm going back. It must have been late 80s, I would say. Actually, no, I tell a lie. I did go to that was one of the first, and it was and the lineup. All I remember was it was like Top Hill, and I can't remember if it was her or somebody, but they got a lot of bottles thrown at them. I do remember that like very clearly. It was absolutely brutal. Can't remember who else was on the lineup, but so I did actually go. Yeah, before that, I went to Nebworth to go and see. I think it might have been Deep Purple. I think Rob Plant might have been there with his solo band. Can't remember who else was there. And it's just lots of 80s metal bands and rock bands. I think that was the first time I went to a proper concert. And it poured down with rain, and I think we left before the headline act. It was that miserable, like the weather.
When
so I'll give you two answers.
That's
there,
fine. That's fine.
All right.
I was going to ask you about, you know, when you started putting sort of Feeder together. You know, who were the bands at the time that
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
We're inspirational to you, but I presume, obviously, Sabbath's in there.
Yeah, if you're the police. Like, you know, we always saw, I remember when I met John, we had a thing, you know, we had a real connection with, you know, we both sort of three-piece bands, and, you know, he was a master student to the police. You know, I've still got some of my original police singles. Can't Stand Losing You. I think you actually was one of the world. But, yeah, I was always sort of, something about three-piece bands I love. So, obviously, the police were a big influence. I mean, early Jam a little bit, but I was probably slightly more on the rock side. So, it was, you know, Black Sabbath, you know, Led Zeppelin. A lot of kind of very kind of mellow stuff as well, like, you know, Fleetwood Mac, Simon & Garfunkel, Pink Floyd. Quite a few punk bands as well, you know, Sex Pistols, obviously, bands like Sham 69 and, you know, Buzzcocks. I was into those kind of bands as well. So, yeah, it was a pretty eclectic, really. It was sort of a combination of what I discovered myself, what my older brother introduced to me, and just kind of what my mates were listening to, sort of growing up in a small town in South Wales. But also, you know, obviously AC/DC, you know, all that kind of stuff, really. So, like, you know, classic rock, punk rock, 70s rock, acoustic stuff, Tom Petty, Neil Young, all that kind of stuff, really.
But every single artist that you've just listed there, Grant, you know, whether they're, you know, they're cranked to 11 playing, you know, full on sort of, you know, 70s rock, you know, or down to something as gentle as Simon & Garfunkel, The Police, whatever. All of them bands that you mentioned, as you were sort of rattling them off, I was thinking they've all got serious pop sensibilities. All of them have got songs with really hooky verses, massive choruses. And, like, do you think that's kind of found its way? You know, because, you know, there's great pop hooks in so much of Feeder stuff. Like, do you think it sort of found its way through that, them kind of sort of the way that these songs were structured to, you know, to have that reaction from the public, to, you know, to have them hooks and them soaring choruses?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. I mean, I think it's just that kind of mix, you know, that all that music that I listen to. I remember having a friend called Brian Sperber that ended up working on a lot of Feeder tracks, and, you know, we're still, you know, good friends now. We're in bands together, and he introduced me to, you know, to lots of American music as well, and that was quite, you know, anything from AOR, being a bands like Boston, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, all these bands have got, like, great melodies, you know. I mean, the 80s gets a bit of a bad rap for rock because there was some really bad stuff around, but there was some good songwriting around, and there was some good, you know, bands in those days could really play as well, you know. 80s bands, you know, they were good players, and there were some, you know, it was when it was all about the big production and layers and backing vocals and harmonies. And I kind of liked some of that, but I liked a bit of that. But I think it was more for what you said, you know, Feeder are known for our melodies, but we also can be, like, pretty heavy at times. I mean, I remember when we first started out, they said, you know, how would you describe Feeder? And I said, well, we're a heavy metal pop band. I know that sounds like a weird label, but it's kind of what we are, because the first music I discovered when I was, like, super young, you know, whenever, you know, my parents were playing or my dad was playing in his car, was stuff like ABBA, you know, pop music. You know, ABBA were a great pop band, so it's all gone in there, and I think it's kind of made me what I am as a songwriter, and it's you know, probably been a big part of why Feeder sound like, you know, like the sound. And even meeting Taka for the first time when we first hooked up in Camden, like, many years ago, he grew up obviously in Japan, he's got an old brother that's about the same difference, so it's, you know, we're quite similar, we both got older brothers that are about 3 years older than us. And I was amazed, actually, how many bands we had sort of, you know, we both listened to as, you know, as we were growing up. It just shows how universal music is, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. So with the early Feeder gigs, Grant, like, you know, we've all been in sort of bands that have, you know, have tried to crack it and not quite got there, and we've played all the kind of, you know, I guess what people refer to as the toilet circuit and, you know, every back room in Camden. What was the first gig you played where you thought, oh, hang on, this is like a proper gig? This is like what I thought gigs were going to be. Do you know what I mean with that question?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, I mean, obviously there was a real scene that happened when we, you know, we sort of started off playing, you know, some tiny places. But I think even before I Attacker joined, when we were starting off, we played, I remember we played at the Marquee Club, and for me, just the name Marquee was just like, we've arrived.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was very early idea of Feeder. We were called Real at the time. It was a terrible name, but we were, it was there that you could see, where, you know, we were pretty raw, but we hadn't quite found our sound. But you could see, we had an idea and you could see there was something like bubbling away. Yeah. And I think just the first time we did that, it just felt like a proper gig. I just don't know if it was just a sort of legendary name of the Marquee, you know? And then obviously, you know, we went on to do all the Camden haunts, you know, like the Water Rats and, you know, Dublin Castle, you know, places like the Monarch, all those places that everyone knows.
I think
it was just the name, just that kind of Marquee, just, you know, it wasn't the original Marquee.
No, I think it
moved to Charing Cross Road,
didn't it?
It wasn't a bad venue, actually. And anyway, that was, I do remember that being a bit of a kind of, oh, wow, you know, we're playing the Marquee.
do you know what? I think I played that in about 1993.
Oh, did you?
And I got sent, an access all areas like band like lanyard thing, and I remember just thinking, oh, I've made it, like I've got, and, it had the Marquee in that kind of, you know, the font that the Marquee's in. I remember thinking, oh, and then I think also when I got a load of paper tickets through, which was fundamentally pay to play at the time, but I remember just thinking, I'm playing the Rock Garden, this is amazing, like I'm playing the Rock Garden, and it was so underwhelming actually getting there and playing it. And it was like, you ain't sold 100 tickets, mate, you owe us, like, and I'm thinking, ain't how I dreamt it.
I did the Rock Garden, I think, actually once or twice. Yeah, it was a funny gig, wasn't it?
Yeah, tiny little stage.
And I tell you what, we played, it was one of our first gigs, actually, I think, when after we sort of, you know, became Feeder and stuff, and Tacker joined, going back, God, I mean, I'm going back over 25 years ago, and we played at a place, do you remember, it was in Covent Garden again, and it was like a kind of hangout, it was a place where you used to basically go to try and pull somebody or whatever, or go and have a burger. It was called the Roadhouse or something.
Yeah, I remember.
Do you remember it?
Yeah.
And they said bands on it, outstage it, and it was so off-putting, because I remember we were playing there, and there was about 20 people in there, if that, and half of them were just in there to have a burger, and they were just sat there eating their burgers. And me and Zachary and John were trying to sort of like rock out, doing this heavy, and it was the most, oh God, it was the most soul-destroying gig. It was just... Actually, I tell you, he used to hang out in there quite a lot. Say, was Lemmy from Motorhead. I used to see him there sometimes. I used to go down. He's probably on the pool.
Well, let's talk about, you know, when we spoke about that sort of first gig where you think, all right, okay, this is feeling good now. This is feeling how it should feel. Tell me about your first. Was your first tour a support or was your first tour a headline?
Well, we did, I don't know what our first, I mean, we did loads of gigs in Cornwall. It's kind of where it was really good for us because we were sort of learning just that whole live experience and sort of, you know, we're getting better as a band, but doing it away from London, which was good because there was a bit less pressure. But I remember doing a Kerrang Twister tour. That was definitely one of the first tours I think we did. And it was with... But it was like a Twister. So basically there was three bands on. One was, if I remember the names right, one was a band called Lodestar, I think. It used to be called something before. Do you remember Lodestar?
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, they're a good band. And then there was a band called the Crazy Gods of Endless Noise or something.
Yep.
And they were kind of quite wacky and Feeder. And we used to sort of, so one night, you know, the Crazy Gods would headline and it would flip. And so we'd all end up headlining one night and then one would be on first and one would be in the middle slot. And it was you know, that was one I remember. That was definitely one of our earliest tours. And we did a lot in that area. And then we went back and did some touring with a band called A, which I know you've done some stuff with, of Jason's. Yeah, it was a really good time, but I think that must have been fun
because they're always good boys, aren't they?
Yeah, oh yeah, great. Yeah, I mean, it worked really well because, you know, we were different, but we kind of worked. It was just a really exciting time then. It was that sort of '90s period. But I remember our first, I suppose, decent sized tour. I think it was after that was with Terrorvision, and Terrorvision, they were still going. And that was quite an important tour for us because I remember we, you know, won over a lot of their fans, and it was a really beneficial tour to us because, you know, we were playing to so many more people than we'd ever played to before. And we just thought, sort of, you know, little three-piece band, people were thinking, well, who's this? And we went down like really well, actually, every night. And that was quite a good sort of building block for us as a band.
But like you, I think Terrorvision at the time, there's certain bands that sort of that transcend, you know, the Enemy, the Melody Maker, and Kerrang. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's a really sweet spot to be in. And I think I definitely think sort of Terrorvision done that. And at the time, I mean, when was this? Was because did the album with like Perseverance? Did that go number one?
I mean, they were quite big. I mean, they had that, and they had, you know, Alice Watson Matter and all that stuff. I mean, they were. I mean, we were a lot heavier than them.
Mm.
I think we were a little bit like, whoa, you know. I think the audience were a bit kind of, whoa, who's this band?
Yeah.
But it just really worked in our favour. I mean, Terrorvision obviously were great. They did their show, but we were quite different to them, and it just worked. It was a really good lineup, and but yeah, I mean, they were a big band then. Yeah, oh, they were doing well, and. You know, for us, it was just like a really great tour, to sort of jump on. I mean, that's what you do as a you know, support band. You hope to sort of to nick a few fans from the main band, and that's what always happens. You know, if it goes down well, it's tough being a support band, but when it connects, it can be really good. And we had a couple of like absolutely blinding tours. You know, we did Terrorvision, then we did Reef, and kind of went from there really. And we picked up a lot. You know, that really helped to grow our fan base.
Did the reality of touring sort of meet your sort of teenage expectations of what being in a touring band were?
Yeah, that's quite typical. I mean, I've always been a bit of a studio. I love like the whole kind of, you know, writing, you know, recording, like production side. I mean, I just love that space, that creativity of being in the studio. But I do obviously. And that might sound odd, but because I do obviously, you know, still love playing live as well. But I didn't really know what to expect. It was certainly a lot of fun. And, you know, the things that, you know, as you get more successful, you probably get more fussy and ask for, you know, expect more things. But you just don't really expect anything, but you just deal with it. And it's all about, you know, using the gear you've got and just hoping everything works and, you know, dealing with a dodgy sound most nights. But it's all part of your musical apprenticeship, really, as a band. And that's something which sort of sets you up, really, for later on. But yeah, I mean, it was a fun time. You know, we definitely had some fun moments. Yeah, there was some. Yeah, I mean, being on the road is great. I think if you've got a good band and you get on well, it's fantastic. If you don't get on, it's a nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's pretty well documented with plenty of bands over the years, isn't it? You know, separate vans and all of that sort of stuff.
I've seen it. Honestly, I've seen it, and I've been on tour with bands. We just know it's just not a happy place, and it just kills the vibe. I think the audience can feel it sometimes, you know. You know, when you see the band on stage, you can see they don't really want to be up there with each other.
I remember reading an interview once with like Roger Daltrey, and he was sort of saying, like, you know, just asking him about hanging out with Pete Townsend, and he was like, no, we don't hang out. Like, we're just in a band. Like, we're not friends. It felt just like, no, we just do this. But then I suppose you think, well, I suppose if you've been in a band with these people for 50 years or however long it's been, you're probably not spending every day in each other's pockets, are you?
No, I mean, not at all. I mean, the thing is, you know, we all have our separate lives, and I think even more so now. And, it's a good thing, because when we come together, it's like a real thing, and it's nice. So otherwise, you just get on each other's nerves, you know. It's the same as anything, you know. It's like a family, you know. There's going to be ups and downs and arguments, but, you know, there's still a bit of that anyway.
Yeah.
But I think having a bit of a sort of life outside, it's not a bad thing. And it's a whole different world now. You know, people can live all over the place and be in a band, whereas before it was a bit more difficult before the internet and stuff like that. But, yeah, I mean, you know, they always say, you know, a band who drinks together is a band that stays together. And it is partly true, you know. I'm not encouraging drinking, but it's I mean, there is a lot of truth in that, you know.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Of all of the bands that you've toured with, what was the one that was probably the most fun? Who did you like going on the road with the most?
Ooh, that's really hard because we hadn't done that many sports sort of recently. But I mean, obviously,
all bands that you've took on tour.
Yeah, I mean, I did have a lot of fun on the Everclear tour in America. This band called Everclear, and they were really big then. And we did I got friendly with Art, my friend Brian, who I mentioned earlier on. The guy who got me to American bands. He was doing some recording with them and hooked me up with Art, and we got on quite well. And he liked Feeder, and I think we were just starting to do quite well then. So I think we were a little bit bigger than Everclear over here, but they were doing like big gigs in the States. And we had some agreement that, he'd let us come and open for them in America. If they could come over here and do a few shows with us. I said, great. So we signed it to Elektra Records and we went there and did that tour. I think it was just the whole experience of being in America. It was that whole, you want about the whole touring experience. But to me, that was like the rock and roll dream, It was chaos. It was hard work. It was tiring, but it was amazing. And some of the places that we went, we did 42 states in a 12 months period. I mean, it was intense. Yeah. But God, it was fun. So, I mean, that was definitely one that I still sort of think, God, yeah, that was such a great tour. And just, I suppose if I had to answer it, I suppose also just playing with some of the big bands that you think, oh my God, I'm on the same stage as, we played with U2 and, we toured with REM a few times. That was great. We played with the Rolling Stones, we've done some amazing gigs. And, we went to the Coldplay when they were huge, and it was, that is a great experience. But just for pure rock and roll fun and debauchery, I would say the Everclear tour.
Wonderful, wonderful. just to ask you quickly, you mentioned, playing gigs with people like, U2 and REM, who are arguably...
Yeah.
The two, certainly, at the point I imagine you were touring, the two biggest bands in the world. Certainly, the biggest selling at that point. Did you ever do you ever get that kind of imposter syndrome? Being there in a room, and I say this with the greatest respect, of course, and I ask most of my guests this. If you walk in a room and there's Bono or there's Michael Stipe or Peter Buck, or The Edge, do you ever just think, how have I got here? This is crackers. Do you ever have them moments where you breathe it in and just think, I'm in a bloody room with you too. This is, I'm gigging with them.
Yeah. I mean, it is a bit surreal, but I mean, at the end of the day, they're normal people, but they are, I mean, a lot of those people you just mentioned, they're sort of legends. And I remember when we did the Rolling Stones, I mean, we did actually quite a few shows with them, and they're tough gigs because the Rolling Stones fans, they're not really that interested in the support bands, doesn't matter who you are. And I've read some interviews, even with I think it was with Dave Grohl years ago, and I think they did some of the similar, there was a time where we were sort of similar level to the Blues, and obviously now they're just gone to that, one of the biggest bands in the world. But, around that sort of comfort and sound time and just before that, we were sort of similar levels. But anyway, I remember Dave Grohl saying that when they opened for the Stones, it was a really tough gig as well. So I was thinking, okay, it wasn't just us. But to answer your question, I remember being backstage with Tacker and stuff and just sort of sitting next to Charlie Watts, bless him, obviously he was sitting around. And he was such a nice guy, he was just there playing pool. And it was just the most surreal. It was like Charlie Watts and Rolling Stones. And then they didn't really hang out all together much. They just sort of, you just see one here and there. But then you have your moment where they come down to the dressing room and you're told the time and the Rolling Stones all come down. And they do your picture, and they're there, and then they're gone. It's the most surreal thing because you think, did that happen? It's like you're there with your arm around,
crackers,
like Keith Richards,
mate.
It was crackers. I still got the photograph, actually. But it was almost like it was so organised and so quick because, you know, they obviously do it all the time.
Sure.
It was the most like surreal moment. So, yeah, to answer your question, it is an odd one. I mean, I remember also we were playing with U2. It was somewhere in Europe. I can't remember where it was. Oh, God. Was it Germany or... Anyway, and it was the worst weather. They had a really good... it was on the Vertigo tour, and they had... a feeder, it was us, Ash, I think the Snow Patrol were doing some of the shows. There was about three or four other bands as well, and they were kind of alternating them. And I remember it was like, there's no way that we can play in this. It was literally pouring down. But they said, oh no, you guys still got to play. So we're like, okay. So we put all this plastic sheeting all over our pedals and all that. Anyway, as we came off stage, we were sat in our dressing room completely drenched through. And I remember like Bono coming in with his entourage and just sort of like sat there for a minute and just had a conversation with him. And that to me was quite bizarre because I sort of grown up, you know, with U2.
Yeah.
Since their early stuff, and just to have the guy there sort of sat next to me, that was quite a moment. And I remember the conversation that we had, if you've got time for it. He was on about, he said, oh, well done, guys, for getting out there and doing that. And I just said, yeah, I was trying not to fall over because it was so like slippery. And he told me that he used to put, or he puts like grip tape, you know, grip tape that you have on skateboards.
Yeah.
He told me a trick to do was he used to put grip tape on the bottom of his shoes. And that's what he told me. Bono from U2, the most bizarre story, but
practical, makes sense as well, doesn't it?
It's just an odd conversation. It's not the sort of thing you imagine to be talking to like Bono from U2 about. But yeah, he was very nice and, you know, like very down to earth.
Amazing. Grip tips with Bono.
Yeah, grip tape. You know, the black stuff. It's like sandpaper, it's sort of sticky. You put on the, you know, on top of the board. So,
while we're talking about sort of big gigs and stuff, what's your favourite festival to play, Grant?
I love Fuji Rock in Japan. It's just a really vibey festival. It's just got that kind of something old school about it. It's got a bit of a hippie vibe. It's just really well organized. It's spotlessly clean. Everyone picks up a litter, you know, very, very Japanese. You know, they have a lot of respect for that. Everything's like recycled. Great PA system. It's loud. There's none of that kind of noise limit stuff where it sounds so, you know, weak and quiet. It rocks.
Yeah.
There's lots of, you know, interesting stages hidden away in the kind of forest and stuff. It's just a beautiful festival, and I absolutely love that one. That's definitely up there for me. As you know, I would say that is my favourite festival, without a doubt. We've done it probably about six or seven times now.
Okay. Well, staying on festivals, Grant, you get to curate your own. Your dream festival, five acts, alive or dead.
Okay, well, listen, look, there's so many new bands I can mention, lots of people, but I remember just go with sort of stuff that I think would just be great about classic. Okay, Beatles, an obvious one.
A headlining? Hey, who's headlining? I want it in order.
Oh, God. Oh, no. Go under the order. All right. oh, that's a tough one. Okay, well, okay, let's say the Beatles headlining.
Okay.
I think they've earned that. Then I've got, before the Beatles, I've got Led Zeppelin.
Right.
Before Led Zeppelin, just to break up a little bit, to make something a bit different, I've got, I'd go with Fleetwood Mac.
Nice.
Before Fleetwood, oh God, this is a tough one now. I've got the order wrong, but see, I've got Pink Floyd, but they're probably they're more of a headline act, but okay. So Pink Floyd, then I've got Tom Petty, because I'm a massive Tom Petty fan. And I've got Black Sabbath just to really open it up with a bit of rock.
Yeah, yeah, perfect.
And this isn't down to whether I think they're big or smaller bands. I'm just trying to make it an interesting order for the audience.
But definitely.
Those are all just bands that have been massively, you know, inspirational to me over the years. I mean, there's so many great bands. You know, I'd love to mention PJ Harvey and Radiohead, all these other bands. But for me, that would just be a hell of a lineup.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'm aware that I've had plenty of time already, Grant. So just before
that's all right.
We wrap things up. Tell me what's happening. What's going on? Feeder news.
Well, feeder move. Well, touch the word. We can carry on playing with all this new thing going on. But We've got a new album out. It's called Torpedo. It comes out on the 18th of March. It's our album number 11, I think. God, that seems like a lot, doesn't it? And then we've got the tour. We've got a UK tour in April that starts on the 23rd of April. And our London show is going to be Brixham Academy. All the dates are up on Feeder Web or up on my Instagram. You can pre-order the album. We've got a new single coming out in the new year as well. And that's all good. I mean, I don't know if you've heard any of the new stuff, but it's definitely a rock album.
Nice.
there's some big riffs on there. So it's sort of a little bit of a sort of move back to I suppose our sort of earlier sound in some way. I'll tell you what happened, right? During the whole, just for the sort of pre-COVID time, which is probably when I talked to you, actually. Yeah. I think I even mentioned that I'd been writing. So I wrote a bunch of songs. We did some recording. Then we got about 8 or 9 sort of finished, obviously not mixed, but basically all the recording done. Then the whole lockdown thing happened. Didn't feel overly inspired for a few months. Picked up my guitar, wrote loads of songs, and basically this album is the result of that. So we decided, we thought, well, we've got a lot of songs. Should we do a double album, which I was really into, but then we changed our minds. So it's going to be 2 albums. So there's sort of pre-lockdown songs, plus some other ones that I've added to those, is going to be the album after this. So it's almost like a double album in 2 halves. Does that make sense?
Totally.
It's very hard to explain, but they're very much connected. I mean, musically a little bit different. But we're using the same artist, so the artwork will like follow a theme. So there'll be quite a collectible thing, I think, for any sort of diehard fans, you know, been having the two of them, you know.
And in regards to sort of like track listing and you know, splitting it up into 2 albums and things like that, you know, we live in a world where a lot of people now sort of cherry pick tracks, what they buy from iTunes and Spotify and things like that. And I mean, is it still really important to you that you know, you sit down and you look at the track listing and you still want that record to come across as a you know, as a piece of art, you know, as a body of work?
Oh my God, even more so than ever. I mean, this album has gone, I mean, every Feeder album goes through a real process of that. I am literally, I drive myself and everyone else around me insane, because I'm just into that whole journey thing. Yeah. I know to most people it's not important, but please, if anyone buys this album, you listen to it from start to finish, because I've sequenced it in a way that it works for vinyl as well. So it's got the sort of side A, side B.
Yeah.
There's basically 10 tracks on the vinyl because you didn't want to put any more on, because you start to lose a little bit of quality if you put too many songs on a record. So the vinyl is 10, and there's a bonus track on the CD. So that's there's an extra track called Desperate Hour, like an acoustic song at the end. But basically, oh God, I spend weeks and weeks getting the sequence right, getting that whole journey right. Some of the songs are connected lyrically, not just on this album, but sort of flowing to the next album. I do that quite a lot, actually. It's something which I really like to do. I might write a song on one album, but I'll continue that sort of like story, like the kind of next chapter, maybe on another record or maybe another 2 records. I mean, I find that actually quite fun. I think the Beatles used to do that, apparently, but it's something which is quite good because it's just sort of, it's almost like a continuation of that story. And I like that. I mean, I like that in songwriting. It's quite a nice thing to do. But yeah, so, yes, I spent a lot of time on that, and we spent a lot of time not just on the sequencing, but on the artwork and, you know, picking the right artwork and artists to work with. To me, that's all part of the process, and that's all part of making a record. It's, you know, obviously the music is the most important thing, but it's that whole package for me. It's such an important thing, you know?
Yeah. I'm a big fan of that as well. I think it's really important in a world where so many things are very quick and, you know, and everybody, you know, seems to want things super fast. I think it's more important now to have something tangible, to be able to sit down and kind of escape for 40 minutes or however long it is. Do you know what I mean? I think these things are, you know, enjoy a bit of art and enjoy the journey of it. I think it's important.
I mean, we work with artists a lot because, you know, to me, I like to work with like creative people, and to me, it gives the album like an identity and a feeling, and it gives, you know, it's just all like creative, and it's just a great thing, you know, and you just find a certain piece of work or an artist or whatever it is that just feels, you know, like the right one. And we've worked with a lot of artists over the years, actually, you know, I mean, probably more than most bands, I would say. Cause, I mean, you know, we've kind of avoided, I mean, there's been a couple But in general, we've never really just gone for the, oh, that's a nice picture, let's put that on the front cover. Which is, you know, often what happens, you know, with the rental companies, just the way they work. But we've had a lot of freedom, and we've been lucky enough to work with some really, really talented people. But yeah, I think, you know, I want to look back on these records, you know, when I'm old and past it, and just have this like collection of work and just seeing them there, and just that moment in time, it just brings back sort of nice memories, you know, for ourselves and hopefully when it's, you know, they support our music over the years, you know.
Lovely. What a beautiful place to finish up the podcast.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Grant, it's been an absolute pleasure getting to catch up with you again, mate. Thank you so much for your time. If people want to keep up to speed with the release dates and where they can buy it and gigs, where's the best place?
Well, you know, Instagram, you know, feed of Facebook, you know, you can go to the website. I mean, you know, it's more about sort of Facebook now and Instagram, right? So Instagram in particular. So yeah, just go on there. All the dates are on there. There's a link there to, you know, to the shop as well if you want to get anything like that. And yeah, come and see us. I mean, what I would say is it's going to be a pretty rocking set. We're going to be playing obviously a lot of new record. It's, you know, there's no point in going out and doing a new album tour and just playing a load of best of all the time. So yeah, of course we'll do a couple of favourites at the end or whatever. But I really want to go back and revisit some of those classic earlier Feeder songs that feel like they really fit what we're doing with this record.
Yeah.
Going back and doing some stuff on Polythene and Swim. And I think that'll be really good fun for us, and also for some of the old school fans who have been asking all these years, oh, you never play so-and-so so many more. Well, we might do it on this tour, so come and see us.
Absolutely, absolutely. Grant, thank you so much, mate. It's been an absolute
pleasure.
Thanks,
Stuart.
Cheers, mate.
Right, thank you.
There you go. Oh, lovely gentleman. Lovely, lovely gentleman. Yeah, it was absolutely wonderful to get to chat to Grant again. We had a lovely little natter afterwards, and that's always a good sign of a good pod, when the guest hangs around and you have a little chat about, you know, what you're up to for the rest of the day. And we spoke a little bit about the Brixton show. He's going to go along and check them out. Yeah, absolute gentleman. Hope you enjoyed that episode. As mentioned at the beginning, go check out, if you haven't already, when Grant first came on the podcast and spoke about all the records that have been very, very important along his creative journey this far. I'm back next time. Take care, you lovely people. Everything you need to know about this podcast, you can either find out about on the social medias, or you can find out about all the social medias, all the Patreon stuff, all the episodes at www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. Take care, lovely people. See you soon. Bye-bye.
It's Off the Beat and Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.